was just a dream. That was just a dream. That's me in the corner. That's me in the spotlight. Losing my religion.
Well, I don't see a show scheduled. Our boys aren't here, and there's nothing on the computer, so we're going to give you a little Boy Golden for the CD for Jimmy.
Mr. Riley laying on a sofa bed, nursing a headache, wishing that he were dead. Or better yet, sitting in the stands, watching all the horses race, grand in his hand, a million more in the bank, ordering a drink. Yeah, he watches the race with a smile on his face. He knows what's going down on the ground. Well, a win is a win, even if it's a sin. He takes his winnings down the underground.
Interview with art history scholar Dr. Oliver Botar. This interview with Dr. Oliver Botar was broadcasted June 20th, 2024, here on CKW 95.9 FM.
Well, hey folks, you're listening to CKW 95.9 FM. This is your Arts Talk radio show, and you're here with co-host Derek Breckner. Co-host Zoe LeBrun is busy working on a film set, so she wasn't able to make it today. But we're going to have a talk here with one guest today, and hopefully we'll see Zoe maybe next week or the following week. We have one guest today. We have a person who's been on here, gosh, I don't know, three or four times. Maybe this is the fourth time in the last 14 years I've been doing this show. We have Professor Dr. Oliver Botar. Professor Botar is, among other things, the chair of the MFA graduate program at the School of Art at the University of Manitoba, and has a long, prestigious career as an art history professor and as a scholar in, shall we say, 20th century European art, with a special emphasis on Mahaly Naj. But today we're here to talk about a book that he has co-edited, Cannibalizing the Canon, data techniques in Eastern Central Europe. For those of you out there, Dadaism was a movement in the early 20th century. We'll get into it with Oliver. We can talk about it. Well, welcome to the show, Oliver.
Thank you very much, Derek. It's lovely to be back.
Yeah.
I love this little room.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we haven't done an interview in here prior to COVID. We did one interview for a documentary that you were involved with during COVID, and we did the interview on Zoom, and then that got filmed. I forget where it got filmed, that documentary you were in.
It was filmed in a lot of places, but that was about Mahaly Naj, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was by the filmmaker Alyssa Namias.
Right.
And she's gone on to do other films and win awards. She's really good.
Yeah.
That was fun.
Yeah. So I'm very excited about this book. I mean, I always think of, you know, Dadaism as a pretty important movement that's, you know, I would say is still influencing contemporary art to this day. There's sort of a cliche phrase, but I think it's sort of true. This that Picasso was a huge influence of the early part of the 20th century, and Marcel Duchamp, heavily associated with the Dadaist movement, was responsible for the most influence on the second part of the 20th century. And I can't help but feeling that's true. Here again, we got the white guy, Western canon kind of ideology sort of talking here, but it's hard to dispute those thoughts.
I would agree with that assessment. I mean, you know, this type of thing is always an oversimplification, but in general, yes. And Duchamp was only one part of the Dada movement, but he was certainly very important. And his conceptual approach to making art, which actually ties him to Mahaly Naj, in addition to being a co-editor, originally editor-in-chief, they invited me to be editor-in-chief, but I felt that my three collaborators were so important to the project that we should all just be co-editors.
Yeah.
But anyway, my main area of interest, Laszlo Mahaly Naj, is related in that he also kind of espoused a conceptual approach to art making, like Duchamp did, but he also went through a brief Dada period. And in fact, I have an article in this anthology, even though I'm one of the editors, two of the editors contributed articles. And my article is on Mahaly's brief Dada period from late 1920 to mid 1921.
I would like to get into that period, because I'm not aware of Mahaly Naj's relationship to Dadaism at all. So I'd like to talk about that, but maybe we can just talk about the book generally first. Would that be okay?
Absolutely.
So give us a breakdown maybe, or I mean, I know we've only got 20 minutes here, but I'm wondering if you can kind of give me a quick breakdown of some of the chapters or key points.
Sure.
Maybe that, from what I've read, this book separates itself from past histories of Dadaism, and that there's a large focus on Eastern and Central Europe. And so maybe we can start there.
That's right. And it's not the first book to do that. There was a book maybe a decade and a half ago that did that as well. Maybe even more than that now, a couple of decades ago. But well, the book is, first of all, I should mention, is based on a conference, an international conference that was held in 2016 at the Kossuth Museum in Budapest, which is a museum devoted to the early 20th century avant-garde and is a part of the literary museum, actually. So by its very nature, interdisciplinary, literary, film, fine art, everything. And it was organized by the person who's now the director of the museum, Mesha Seredi is his name, Mesha Pal Seredi, along with Gabor Dobo, and who is a research fellow at the Kossuth Museum. And they organized this conference in 2016. They brought people from all over in to discuss Dadaism in East Central Europe. And I did not present at that conference. I have presented at other conferences, but not that one. But there were excellent scholars, and that was the basis of the project. And a number of the authors did actually present papers there. And it developed into this book project. It was published by Brill. Brill is one of the oldest academic publishers in the world. It's a Dutch publisher. And so it's a scholarly book, definitely. And it ended up being very big. And the good thing about Brill is that they don't seem to limit us. We ended up with a book that's over 600 pages long. And that's even after we left out some of the contributors who just didn't, in the end, pan out. Anyway, the concept was that we didn't want just as you said, a regular history of Dada, even if we focus on East Central Europe. What I should say about Dada historiography in general is that it is Western focused, and the canon, the canonical approach, the standard approach, is that there were six cities in which Dadaism happened, starting in Zurich in 1916 during the war, you know, and then it went to Berlin after the war and became very left wing. Then it spread to Paris as well, where it kind of developed, morphed into the Surrealist movement eventually.
And they've got New York too, as well,
but
right?
But there was also New York during the war, this is the First World War, but also there were two other centers, Cologne and Hanover. Hanover, basically Kurt Schwitters, who was a very influential collage and montage artist, but also Cologne with Max Ernst and other people. So that's the standard. But many of the major founding figures actually came from Eastern Europe. Tristan Tzara was one of the founding figures of Dadaism, and he was a Jew from Romania. And so, and there were others as well who were from Eastern Europe, some of them Jewish, who then went on to found the movement in Zurich and Paris and Berlin. So we were interested in East Central Europe. So let's say from Vienna eastwards. So Vienna, Eastern, Lower Austria, Poland, the former Czechoslovakia, Hungary, former Yugoslavia, Romania. And those are the areas where we got authors to focus on. Mm-hmm. We tried to get people working on the Ukrainian avant-garde, which was very important to the rise of Dadaism and also Dada-adjacent poets and figures. And we couldn't get anybody. We couldn't get anybody from Bulgaria. We couldn't get anybody of the Baltic countries. But otherwise, we did cover the territory quite well. But we didn't only want to focus. We didn't want to be only a geographical focus. We wanted to focus on techniques. So we call it, that's why the title says Cannibalizing the Canon, Dada Techniques in East Central Europe. So techniques such as photomontage, montage, collage, performance, where the goal was to insult people, épater le bourgeoisie, you know, insult the bourgeoisie, upset them. Because as many people will know who know a little bit about Dadaism, it was a response to the horrors of the First World War, which seemed to signal kind of bankruptcy of Western culture, Western patriarchal culture. Not that the Dada movement wasn't patriarchal in its own sense. Mm-hmm. It definitely was.
Yep.
And we also tried to deal with that by trying to find as much content as possible that would focus on the role of women and also queer people. And we can get to that later on as well. So that's the concept.
That's great. You know, there's a few things in my mind. Like, I start thinking about that, you know, going to these other countries. I mean, I'm assuming that you and the other editors, like, I know you have a Hungarian background. So, so if you're going into Hungary and starting to do research on Hungarian artists, it's probably well, not easy, but it's going to be malleable for you in terms of being able to know language. Did the other editors, were they able to like go into other countries and know the languages like you do for Hungary?
So,
and
good point. I should name the other editors.
Yeah.
So Mersha Pál-Szedady and Gábor Dobó are both Hungarian.
Okay.
And the fourth editor, Irina Denischenko, is Russian originally, but Russian-American, and she teaches at Georgetown University. So having her perspective was very important for us because she brings a feminist perspective, which is very transnational.
Yep.
She actually does speak Hungarian. She studied at Central European University, that wonderful graduate university in Budapest that was forced out of the country by the current less than savory government of Viktor Orban and Fidesz. But so that's how that she was involved in that conference originally.
Okay.
But what we did do is we reached out to Czech scholars, Polish scholars, Yugoslav, Serbian, Croatian scholars, and Romanian scholars, and we got wonderful contributions from all of those countries. So we depended on the network that the Koshak Museum has established in being as transnational as they can possibly be.
Sorry to interrupt, but tell me about the Koshak Museum. Where is that?
Yeah, that's a good point. So the Koshak Museum is named after Lajos Koshak, who was the central figure of the Hungarian early 20th century Hungarian avant-garde. He was a poet and an editor. He was a working-class poet and editor of the journal called Ma Today, which is one of the longest-lived avant-garde journals in history, actually. It lasted for 10 years. Almost 10 years, 1916 to 1925, published in Budapest and then later on in exile in Vienna. And this museum houses his archive and other archives, which they've collected over the years. It's an absolutely fantastic collection. And it's part of the Petőfi Literary Museum, which is a central literary museum of Hungary. So it's a department of that, but they have a separate building, a separate a place where they have regular exhibitions, events, performances, film screenings, and they have this wonderful archive where scholars come from all over the world to research.
Okay, interesting. So it's a cultural center then. It's not exclusively based on visual arts.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
Exactly.
So, you know, you've got all your colleagues here working together with this. Can you talk maybe about, like, you know, after all the research, when do you start seeing the direction in terms of where the book's going? And
yeah, so we had a lot of meetings about that. We had a lot of discussions. We had a hard time agreeing on a term for the territory we wanted to focus on.
Yeah.
East Central Europe. We should it be Central and Eastern Europe? Should it be Central Europe? Should it be Eastern Europe? We finally decided on a standard term, which has become standard since 1989, so since the big changes of fall of the Berlin Wall and everything.
Yeah.
And because it does mean something to people today, or at least to some people. But I want to emphasize that we didn't only have articles that focused on events that happened in those countries that I mentioned, but also on people who came from those countries and went mainly to Berlin and Paris
during the 20s.
During the 20s, exactly.
Yeah.
So we also take the period and push a little bit to the late 20s, essentially. There's even one article that compares the classic avant-garde period of the 1920s with the neo-avant-garde in Hungary of the 1960s and 70s. Yeah. So it was quite generous in our boundaries, but we wanted to focus on techniques and not on media and not on geography.
Yeah. I think it's interesting, you know, I'm sort of going off topic with the next comment here, but I think it's interesting about the Dadaist movement is that there's a lot of disputes about when it started and where.
Yeah.
And it's still continuing. It's not an answer that's going to be resolved. But for you, I guess, you know, for you, it's about kind of expanding where this movement existed. And so, you know, you've talked about kind of it sort of expanding beyond patriarchal influences, I guess, and going into feminism and queer studies and things like that. Maybe you can talk a little bit about like how that kind of fits in with East Central Europe as the term goes.
Sure. So, you know, this whole aspect is really interesting and was very difficult, actually. We had some success, less than I would have liked and that the rest of the editors would have liked, in focusing on women. See, the role of women is interesting in Dada. They tended to be, considered to be marginal to the movement. But in fact, women were involved in the organization of the journals, the editing, that kind of stuff, which is always the case. You know, yeah. I mean, yeah. Lajos Kozak's partner, who was the first professional performer of Dadaist poetry in the world, and she performed it in a number of languages. Her name was Yolan Shimon. She, you know, literally took in sewing to fund the journal. You know what I mean? It's like her, you know, she literally had to do, you know, that kind of labor,
yeah,
and to organize stuff. Yeah, anyway, so women also were very involved in the performances, because there were a lot of performances associated with Dada, theatrical performances, poetry performances, music performances. And of course, these were poorly documented very often.
Yeah.
So often we just have a name. We don't even know who the person is. And so there are some articles that try and do some archaeological research, you know, to figure out.
That's what I'm kind of wondering about. Like, can you talk to me about some of the gems that you and your colleagues sort of came across in terms of things that you found in bibliotheques and archives? Yeah. And were there any things that kind of stand out?
Yeah, there was one author who was actually, this book appeared in a series called Avant-Garde Cultural Studies. And one of the editors of that series, a guy by the name of Hubert Vandenberg, a Dutch scholar who teaches in the Czech Republic, he came up with originally wrote a very long article, too long, about women in Dada. But he finally came up with this wonderful article called Two Mysterious Mademoiselles, Jeanne Rigaud and Maria Cantarelli. And he tried to identify them using very complex series of nested puns to try and figure out who they were. And he also pointed out that people like Hannah Hirsch, who is very often, you know, like she's obviously, you know, one of the important Dadaists, right? Mm-hmm. She did all these amazing... She was one of the co-developers of Photo Montage. And she did these Dadaist, you know, puppets and everything. And also Sophie Teuber-Arp, who was involved in the mm-hmm. Zurich Dada movement. But he points out that both of those women, they, when you ask them, they said, oh, no, I wasn't a Dadaist, even though they were involved. So there was I think they felt excluded. They felt marginalized by these guys who were really trying to bring about a social and cultural revolution in society, but they would fall back in the old patriarchal patterns. You know, the women would end up, you know, serving the coffee and doing the editing and, you know, doing the distribution and that kind of stuff. And sometimes they'd be involved in the performances. So no major discoveries, but there was one. There's Megan Forbes, a brilliant young American scholar who specializes in the Czech avant-garde. She actually did some wonderful work, and I'm just looking for on a woman by the name of Mira Holtzbakova, who did very interesting performances in Czechoslovakia. So she tried to uncover her and did a very good job actually in coming up with some material about her.
And sorry, what's the person's name? The performance artist?
Mira Holtzbakova, and it's Megan Forbes, the scholar.
Okay.
And so the general conclusion is that this is tough.
Yeah.
It's really tough to do this research. More research has to be done. Newspapers, archives, people have to focus on it, have to really go out and look for it.
Yeah.
And this is the same with the queer aspect of things. Let's face it, and I point this out in our introduction, which we wrote jointly. Dadaism itself is queer. It's mm-hmm. queer because it was always trying to go off in different directions, tangents, and look at things from different angles, right?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like, you know, and I guess we can debate whether this is queer or not, but for me, like, I think of, you know, Marcel Duchamp and his alter ego Rose Célavive, you know, and so clearly he's performing in drag, and in my mind, I'm thinking that's got to be the first time an artist has done that, you know, as part of their practice.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, it's like 1913 or something.
No, that was 19 around 1920, 21.
Yeah, okay. So
if you read it, it's double R, Rose Célavive.
Yeah.
But if you read it as Air Rose Célavive,
yeah, it translates into something.
Eros is life.
Okay.
So life is a sexual urge, right? But so yes, absolutely. Duchamp did that, and there were other examples of it. But in general, trying to kind of twist culture to make it work in different ways.
Yeah.
Within queer studies, that is a marker of queerdom, you know, if you like. And yet, we couldn't find a single scholar who was willing to tackle that. Really, that subject. And we really looked hard. There are a couple of articles where, you know, we allude to that the queer aspect of things, but and there were queer people. There were people at least who were bisexual who were involved in this. Yeah. But it's very hard. It's also hard with sexuality. Anybody who's into queer studies knows it's very hard. The definitions change, you know, but the very term homosexual, which preceded the term heterosexual, was invented by a Hungarian. So even, you know, that kind of deep, there are deep roots of queer studies in Central Europe.
And then, of course, you're also having people like camouflage themselves, and you know, because of being illegal or whatever. And
it was illegal, right? There's a book a couple of years old done by Anita Kurmai called Queer Budapest, which is fantastic, and which has a lot of, you know, historical queer research goes into police archives. But getting back to Dada, you know, again, it is something that one has to focus on. And I am not an expert in queer studies. I'm not an expert in feminist studies. So we're hoping that we're also going to stimulate more research with this book to look into these things. And we actually call for this in the introduction.
Yeah. And, you know, I was like looking at the promo for the book too, and it talks about, like, you know, working outside the Western canon. Can you talk about that at all?
Yes. So the Western canon, I mentioned the six canonical cities where Dada was supposed to happen. But, you know, Dada went much further than that. That canon was established by Alfred Barr an exhibition in 1936 at the Museum of Modern Art called Dada and Fantastic Art, Dada and Surrealism, something like that. Yeah. And that was the canon that he established. It's very much an American canon. And it's been reproduced over and over and over again in Dada exhibitions. Yeah. Even recent Dada exhibitions, which were fantastic. There was one at MoMA maybe 10 years ago.
Part of the American-European hegemony here.
Yes. So we're trying to, I guess, the term cannibalizing the canon, that comes from Francis Picabia, who was one of the great Cuban French Dada artists. And he had a painting called Cannibal and a journal called Cannibal. And the idea of eating your own species and kind of producing something different was very important to our conception of the volume.
Huh, interesting. So for you then, like, how does that kind of fit into going outside the Western canon? Like, is it something that's still, like, do you think it's possible to do that, or?
Absolutely. And but the canon has to be expanded not only geographically, not only from the point of view of media. So there's never been much of a focus on Dada performance because of the lack of documentation,
which I feel like that's the whole thing in some ways.
It's so important, but and people have recognized that, but it's just hard to get information on it. But I think we can keep digging, you know, we can keep digging and finding more information and more archival sources and other sources. But to go beyond and also focus on, really do that work, find those women, find what they did, especially in performances, because the performances were full of women.
Yeah.
The Dada performances. And yes, you're absolutely right. But also looking for the sources of Dada in Futurism, for example, which was politically so different, but still, you know, was the source of a lot of Dada activity.
You know, like, I keep thinking of the book by Rosalie Goldberg, The History of Performance Art.
Yes.
And, you know, and she kind of begins it with, well, in some ways she begins it with ritual, like outside of the Western canon, but it begins with Dadaism, Futurism, Cubism, you know.
That's right. So one way we tried to disrupt the standard canon was the way that we organize the chapters. Okay. So we have, or we call them parts, actually, because each article is a chapter. So part one is topographies, and that focuses on the transnational aspects of a transnational approach to researching Dada. The second part is called In Exclusions. So that is where we try and focus on articles where, you know, who was excluded, who's in, who's out, who's in the standard canon, who can we bring in to the canon. The third part is called performativities, where we on purpose called it performativities to kind of hint towards the different types of performance that were possible, right?
Yeah.
And then the fourth part is called transpositions. So that's where, you know, people who transpose from different perspective, transpose medially, transpose geographically, who transpose from the point of view of gender. So transpose in any different, in any way. And then part five, hybrid identities, where we brought together the word hybridities and identities. So where we talk about the multiple identities that people had, both ethnic and, you know, political, any kind of identities. And that's what we conclude the book with. So we did not want, you know, we did not want to break it down by country. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
We wanted to do it intermedially, transnationally, from the point of view of networks, from the point of view of how information was disseminated through journals, through correspondence, all kinds of things. So we really tried to move outside of, you know, standard art historical approaches.